You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. So, Patrick, question. Mm-hmm. I know that you are kind of omnivorous in the world of comics. You've done a lot of DC reading over the years. You've done some Marvel reading over the years. Do you have a particular run of a particular thing that sort of like sits in your bones? Any favorites?
So here's what's fun. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
And the reason I don't know is because when I was heavy into comics and I had the, you know, the $200 a month comic book habit.
Oh, yeah. Serious stuff.
And I was Dave's favorite customer at at the card and comic shop in Fresno where I bought all my comics at the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't really pay attention to who was writing or who was drawing things.
Isn't it always like, the way? You just want the thing. Yeah.
But it's kind of funny because I'm also like I will watch a show or something and someone's like, oh, the show written by and directed by blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, who? I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, that's just how I did. So I can tell you, like, I remember some things I did not get when it came to DC. I was mostly a Batman and a Green Lantern person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those were my favorites at DC. I also really got into Green Arrow.
Okay.
Because I liked the Archer thing. On the Marvel side, I was very much into Spider-Man, and I really enjoyed all the X titles. But as with all of these things, the crossover events started to piss me off.
Oh, yeah.
And there was tons and tons of crossover events. But to this day, I still have in my collection Crisis on Infinite Earths – or Infinite Earths. I always say Infinitive. Infinite Earths.
I mean, that's the more like grammarian version of it. Sure.
Yeah. And I still have the cover that shows a very visibly upset and crying and devastated Superman holding the body of Supergirl.
Those are good. Those are good gets, though. Those are good gets. Yeah. So if there's any crossover event, I think that both of us can agree is a good thing in the world of comics. It's the world of kind of like comics culture and history with the comics themselves. We had the Invisible Women approach to the Marvel history of women writers and editors that we did. Gosh, it was about a year and a half ago. I want to say that we had that episode. And so it feels like an excellent companion piece to it to have William Bernhardt on for the Superman Wars, a battle for truth, justice, and an American icon. William, welcome aboard.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I asked Patrick about favorites and kind of, you know, starting points and things in the world of comics. What drew you not just to Superman, but to the particular history of Superman's evolution and ownership?
Well, those are two different questions separated by, I don't know, like 50 years. But
fair.
I think my first introduction to Superman when I was a kid, they had the Filmation cartoons, the New Adventures of Superman came in the 60s, and I loved that. And, you know, they probably only made like 12 of them, so you'd see the same thing over and over again, but that was okay. And
that show is not well known. Like, not a lot of people today still remember that.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that. It came out on DVD not too long ago, and I bought the set, you know, just to relive all those memories, put it in. Unwatchable. I mean, I'm sorry if there are Filmation people watching, but these are terrible. I understand they had limited budgets, but man, you had to be six or so, I think, to love those. But fortunately, there's been a lot of good Superman since.
Yeah.
How I got interested in researching this story, which is basically the story of Jerry Siegel, the guy who came up with the idea for Superman, which you would have thought would have made him fat and happy for the rest of his life. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. I know a little bit about it, but I wrote a novel, a legal thriller called Justice for All, which kind of dealt with these art versus commerce conflicts. Mm-hmm. And that inspired me to start taking a deeper look into this. And I was just appalled. Okay. And the more I knew, the more I learned. I eventually dug up some stuff that hasn't seen the light of day before, which doesn't make the story better, unfortunately. It just makes it more tragic. And I realized this is, you know, this is a story that goes beyond just comic book fans. This is a story that's relevant to anybody, especially anybody interested in history, pop culture, or other creatives like you guys, because, you know, those vultures are still out there. What happened to Jerry Siegel could still happens today.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I those who pay very much attention at all to, like, the Marvel Universe, for instance, are probably very aware of the gentle term I will use is complicated history between Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, right, and just about any other creator name out of a hat from Marvel, and stack it up against Stan Lee, and we'll see some real tension of the question of ownership and control and credit and so on.
Same thing on the DC side, not just with Superman, but with Batman. I mean, you had Bob King and Bill Finger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm going to get to that too in time too, but that's next year.
Okay, all right. Then I guess we'll see you in a year.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, It's more tragic when we're talking about Superman because he was the first. You know, This really was a genius level idea that Jerry Siegel came up with in the 11th grade. He invented a whole genre, the superhero story, and he gave credence to this brand new medium that started in 35. The comic book, which, you know, had mid sales until Superman hit the scene, then it was a big deal. But of course, as you know, the company took control of the character and ownership from Jerry, and 10 years later, they're unemployed and have had their names removed from the feature, even worse. And that had a huge impact on the comic book industry because, you know, if you can screw over the guys who created Superman, you can do it to anyone, right? That's why people have called this the original sin of comic books. And you saw that for decades, people not getting credit, not being recognized. You mentioned the Marvel movies and others that have proved that these characters now have billion-dollar properties.
Oh, sure.
Why aren't all the creatives rich? You know, why is it just the suits? That's not the way it should be.
It feels particularly bitterly ironic in the case of Superman, not just because it's to your point, the original sin, but because Superman himself as a character is this kind of he emerges out of the tragedy of the destruction of his entire civilization and to adopt a world which is in its own way both a broken and a hopeful place, and to try to be the best possible version of what a human being can be when he is, by the strictest biological definition, not human like the rest of us. Yeah, and to take that character and to turn him into kind of an economic cudgel in the interests of corporate power feels particularly bitter.
Yeah. Well, when Jerry was creating the character, who, like you said, is from another planet, it's basically the Moses story, which, you know, as a young Jewish teenager, he would have known very well. You know, they put the kid in the basket and he goes a long ways and gets adopted by other people and becomes a hero. It's Moses in outer space. He's reversing prior science fiction features like, say, Flash Gordon, where it's always an Earth guy who goes somewhere else, the planet Mongo, and straighten things out. But in Superman, it's the alien who comes here to deal with our problems, which is exactly what Jerry wanted. Remember, he's writing in the 30s. He's just after Prohibition. He's in the midst of the Great Depression. A quarter of the population's out of work. Crime is on the rise. The mob is on the rise. There's a looming war in Europe and so much prejudice. And here's Superman, who Jerry says in the very first story is the champion of the weak and oppressed. And he is. If you read those early stories, he's not dealing with supervillains or aliens. That stuff all comes later. Jerry has him dealing with the problems of the day. He's like a FDR New Deal crusader taking on the problems of his time.
I think
in
that
very first story, you know, in Action Comics number one, 13-page story, and he takes on a spouse beater. He takes on war profiteers, prevents Lois from being kidnapped, of course, prevents an innocent woman from being executed. And that's in 13 pages.
You know? He's busy. No, yeah.
Super speed. No wonder they called it Action Comics. It was.
But I also think there's something, you know, back to that point of we are not yet at the supervillain space invader, something from another dimension, something coming from beyond. The idea that we can see our own problems confronted by someone who, yes, has powers that the rest of us don't have, but sort of fundamentally his core power is his decency.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, which is the thing that directs all of his choices and, you know, how those powers are used.
Sure. I mean, here's a guy who could take over if he wanted to, and most people would, right, with that power set. But he does the exact opposite. Instead, he assumes this meek, mild-mannered identity and kind of a background role while helping people on the side when he can, not for any remuneration or fame or anything. He just does it because he was raised by a nice farm couple in Kansas and they taught him to be a good boy. And so that's what he tries to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the world of research, the term that's used to kind of distinguish between types of sources is like primary and secondary sources, for listeners who are maybe a little farther removed from high school than I am, you know, teaching in a high school and all of that. You never really escape it once you start teaching it. You're just sort of forever stuck in high school, which
in a way.
And the secondary sources, that's when you find a history compiled by some person or group of persons about a person or situation. But primary sources, these are texts that come out of the historical situation itself, that are written by people who are engaged in the situation. And so much of the Superman Wars is kind of rooted in those primary texts. Can you talk to us about some of the primary source things that you found yourself accessing and what that experience was like, how you found yourself using that stuff?
Sure. I mean, for a book that starts more than 90 years ago, there's an amazing amount of primary research in this book. People I was able to talk to and interview about the events, first and foremost, the Siegel family. Jerry's daughter, Laura, is still with us, and her two sons, Jerry's grandsons, Michael and James, and they have not talked a lot to previous writers. I mean, they make public appearances, but not so much giving interviews. In fact, the first email I got from Laura started with, "I don't normally give interviews," and I thought, oh, this is off to a good start. But slowly but surely, you know, I said, well, could you just confirm this and what about that? And pretty soon she was sending me pages of stuff. She was really a very warm, wonderful person. And I talked to other people who knew Siegel and Schuster personally who are still with us. And I'm not wishing the worst for anybody, but there's kind of a, you know, moment in time aspect because nobody lives forever. And right. I was lucky to get some of that down on paper. I even found unpublished manuscripts. You know, Jerry wrote about 100 pages of an autobiography that he never finished, but I got that. He did a script for what was supposed to be the last Superman story, a synopsis, I should say, in 1986. You may remember when they supposedly ended the first era of Superman and John Byrne took over. Jerry was supposed to write the last story. He didn't get to for various reasons, but he had a script for it. He's got a script for a Superman versus Batman story that's about, I don't know, 60 years before there would be a movie similarly titled. All kinds of wonderful things that and of course all the correspondence, which is key to the wars, the litigation part of this that goes on for almost 70 years. There's 10 years of, you know what happened in 1937. Jerry wanted a newspaper strip, but he couldn't get one. Newspaper comic strips were the big guns at that time. Everybody read those. Comic books were new and scruffy and considered kind of low rent. But finally, when he had literally been rejected by every newspaper syndicate he could find, they just couldn't see it, you know? Here's the guy in tights holding a car over his head. Sure. It was just too different for people. But the guy who had invented what we call the modern comic book and started the first comic, Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, former military officer and writer, a good writer, apparently, nominated three times for the O. Henry Award. He saw the potential, and he wanted to do Superman back in 35, but Jerry said no. It was only after Jerry had tried everything else that he finally agreed to it. Unfortunately, the virtual seconds, a mere few weeks before Superman debuts, the company is taken over by somebody else, a guy named Harry Donenfeld, with mob connections and a former rum runner during Prohibition, indicted twice for pornography. I could go on and on, but he, with his business associate, Jack Leibowitz, end up taking the company just, you know, at the last moment. And Jack sends Jerry a litter agreement. He'd never seen anything like this before, and saying, yeah, we'll pay you $130 for this story and keep reading, because the last paragraph says basically, and by the way, you're signing over all the rights to all the characters who appear in this story. And that's how they lost control of Superman. You sometimes hear people say they sold Superman for $130. So not true. They got $130 because they got $10 a page for a 13-page story. That's the $130. They got nothing additional for the rights to Superman. And, you know, I would have made a fuss about that if I'd been handling the lawsuits, but unfortunately, I wasn't around. Jerry goes to war in 1943 in World War II. He's drafted. He spends about 2 years overseas, comes back to find the company, run now by Harry and Jack, has basically taken over his character. They've hired everybody in-house, including his best friend and co-creator, Joe Shuster, who drew the strip. And they're calling the shots. And there is 10 years of acrimonious litigation between Jerry and Jack Leibowitz. It's just abusive. I mean, it's in the book. Read it for yourself. But Jack so cruel, mean-spirited, insulting, taking advantage of the boys' relative youth, threatening to fire them constantly, even though they supposedly have a 10-year employment agreement. So Jerry's been putting up with that for years. And then he comes home and finds not only have they taken control of Superman, but they've started running Superboy. Superboy was Jerry's idea. He wanted to create a new character, well, semi-new, Superman when he was young, and he's in a rural setting, and he's playing pranks on people with his powers and that kind of stuff. Jack rejected that script three times. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, while Jerry's overseas, he runs the story and it's successful. So they start a whole new Superboy series and they've never bought the rights. They never even bought the script. They don't even have a color of right to run the story. They just did it anyway. And that's when Jerry decides enough already. And he files the first lawsuit in 1947, which does not go the way he wanted it to. He does get a little bit of money on Superboy, which basically pays his legal fees and debts, but he does not get the rights to Superman back. And worse, they fire him. Despite having this employment agreement, they fire Jerry and Joe, and even worse, remove their names from the credits, which I think legally, whether they could do it, I don't know. We could argue that, but morally and ethically, that is just wrong. Stripping an artist's credit from their work, that's just wrong and should be illegal if it's not. Even when they would reprint old stories, you know, that had been previously published, they'd color over the names. I mean, how did that benefit the company? It didn't. That's just spite. Yeah. That's just mean-spirited.
Yeah. Wow. You know, there's a certain I'm going to return again to that, to the irony here as kind of a thesis, but like the idea that the first step towards losing Superman is that the company's taken over effectively by a mob proxy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like that.
Harry was very proud of his mob connections, so I don't know why we can't talk about it. It's a fact.
it's kind of, it would almost be hilarious. It's the sort of writer's room thing that if we were to propose it for a comic strip, might be pushed back to you as being too on the nose.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a lot of that in this story, but anyway.
The saddest part is that this is just the beginning of a long history in comics of erasing creators.
Right, right. If they can do it to him, you mentioned Bill Finger, you mentioned Jack Kirby, who we're only now beginning to learn how much he had to do with characters like Spider-Man that his name didn't even appear on.
Yep.
That was just devastating for Jerry then. And there are two saving graces. Jerry clearly is the model for Clark Kent. I mean, he was shy. He was awkward around girls. He had those coin eye, Clark's a little eyeglasses. Clark's a little taller, but that whole pretends to be cowardly and awkward and stuttering, that's Jerry. Joe hired a young woman to model for Lois Lane. He usually used magazine illustrations for models, but he thought, where am I going to find a picture of a woman being carried through the air by somebody? That's not going to happen. So he hired this woman who eventually will go by the name Joanne Carter to be the model for Lois Lane. 13 years later at a cartoonist ball, these people are all going to meet up again. Jerry and Joanne fall in love and end up getting. So the model for Clark Kent marries the model for Lois Lane. And if that weren't good enough, they have a daughter, Laura, who grows up to be what else? A reporter.
Of course.
An award-winning reporter. I mean, I couldn't make it up better than that.
My word.
Unfortunately, those were the worst times for Jerry. You know, he had made some money in the early days of Superman, but it's not going to last forever. There's this idea that Jerry was out there just whining for decades. Not true. And that's covered in the book, too, because he hustled like nobody you would believe hustled. He wanted to be a writer. He considered himself a professional writer. He kept sending things out, trying to get work. He'd been kind of blackballed, though, by Harry and Jack. So few people would give him work. He did edit for a while for Ziff Davis. He wrote, get this, more than 170 stories for the Italian Disney comics. He was writing for like Donald Duck and that whole family, Huey, Dewey, and Louie and stuff.
Wow.
I've read some of his Donald Duck stories and I like them, but they're basically superhero stories. Donald, instead of getting mad at everybody, gets superpowers or goes time traveling or whatever. Yeah. But I'd rather see that.
He had an itch he needed to scratch, and Donald was just going to have to do it.
Yeah, right. So he was hustling the whole time. He was also having some tough times. There are a lot of public letters that he sent in 1951, which are really out there. He was clearly in – and I get it, because his daughter, Laura, had been born in April of 51. I have daughters due. You want to do anything you can for them, right? But he couldn't because he didn't have the income. And I think that caused a lot of stress. He sent mad letters to Harry and Jack. And when that didn't produce a response, he started sending them to everybody at the company, everybody Harry and Jack knew, like the bartender at a club where they went out to work. Wow. He's just blanketing with these very extreme letters. I think today, if this happened, we would probably say that Jerry had a nervous breakdown, basically. Sure. And you know what pulls him out of it is Joanne. It's his wife, who, remember, doesn't marry him when he's flush with Superman money. She marries him when he's not, when he's lost a lawsuit and doesn't have a steady job. She marries him because she loves the guy, and she takes care of him and Joe and basically becomes the agent they never had. Some people have hassled and criticized Joanne. I think they just don't get it. She's what's keeping those guys alive. Joe was losing his eyesight and couldn't work anymore. Jerry wrote in that autobiographical extract I mentioned that he felt suicidal at times. And I get it. I think that comes through in the letters. She's what held them together.
Wow. Wow. What a crazy journey. I mean, I don't know if the arc of your research, and apparently some research you're starting to do into the Batman legacy as well, has put you in a position to be able to answer this question or speculate on it, but I'll pose it anyway. Are you developing a sense from your work into the history of comics development and ownership that we're starting to reach a better landscape for creators than we used to have? Or are we really just seeing modern twists of a lot of the same original sins, going back to the term you used before?
Yeah, I think in some senses, it's better now than it was, but there's still a lot to be done. Just to be clear, in 1975, some people will remember this, there was a huge PR campaign to get Siegel and Shuster some kind of compensation, which actually starts not with the courts, not with lawyers or companies or anything like that. It starts with fans. Jerry writes, he called it a press release. It's over 9 pages long. It's like an extended rant talking about everything these people have done to him for decades. Although when you check out the citations and go back to the letters, it's dead on accurate, but he's clearly upset. He made 1,000 copies, sent it everywhere he could think of, and gets back crickets. Basically nothing. Nobody's interested until finally. But by the 70s, we finally have the, you know, adult comic book fans and collectors. I mean, they were always there, but what I'm trying to
now
say
they're
is
adults.
Now,
yeah.
Now they're organized, yeah, and now they're publishing what we called fanzines, amateur publications. That's where the story first gets picked up. One fanzine, then another, some of these with really small circulations, but the word gets out and eventually a Washington paper picks it up and more, and they get invited on television. Neil Adams and Jerry Robinson take up the cause. And finally, around Christmas in 75, big publicity, DC Comics agrees to give Siegel and Shuster an annual pension of, wait for it, $20,000, basically what they were paying their secretaries or assistants at that time. Just to put this in perspective, today, on average, Superman makes Warner Media, that's the parent company that owns DC, they're part of the Warner Brothers family, at least today, that could change soon, but every year, Superman makes this company, on average, $450 million, whether there's a movie or not, there's toys and games and underoos. It's a huge cash cow, and they found $20,000 for the guys who created this. To be fair, they would later get cost of living increases, but to me, it was a token gesture at best. But getting back to your question, Tracy, in 76, for the first time, the powers that be, because I think they were dissatisfied with all the bad publicity they got the year before, they bring in Jeanette Kahn to run DC Comics. So for the first time, this comic book is not run by, you know, mob flunkies and their descendants. It's run by someone with actual business education and business experience. One guy I interviewed said, this was when we stopped keeping sales figures on the backs of envelopes and started acting like a real company. Wow. And in time, Jeanette Kahn did make a difference. She recognized, and she told me, I had the pleasure of corresponding with her too, and she said she realized in time that the primary audience for comic books was no longer 8-year-old boys, if it ever was. It was primarily college age and older people, and they were losing that audience to Marvel. And the only way they were going to get it back as if they started doing more sophisticated material, but they couldn't get the best talent because they weren't paying them enough. People couldn't make a living just working in comic books. So she, working with Paul Levitt, started to put together fairer packages for their creatives, and did. I mean, could it be better? Yeah, it absolutely could be better. Yeah. But that was the first big step in the right direction.
I'd throw it out, Tracy, that also, I mean, the reason Image Comics exists, right?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Is because even in the 90s, it wasn't great. Like, if you created a character and you were at one of the two big houses, then they owned that character.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you had Todd McFarlane, who's like, I got this thing in my back pocket called Spawn. I don't want Marvel to own it.
Yeah.
And you had Rob Liefeld, you know, doing the same thing. He's like, I got these characters. I don't want to. And they were big enough at the time because of their art and their storytelling and the things that they were doing with X-Factor, New Mutants, Spider-Man, I think was Todd McFarlane.
Yeah.
That they just decided to do the other thing, you know, so they could be creator owned. I think today, like, it's the same old shit, different story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because now you've got AI in the mix, right? So there's now that. You create something and they're like, well, there's the cupcake. Have you seen that story about the cupcake?
I don't know that one.
It was created by a lady and it was like a strip or something. And she did it for New York Times or some website.
Yeah.
And it was like this thing that she did and it was very popular, but then she stopped doing it for whatever reason. And the company announced that they're going to restart that comic series, but using AI and not involving her at all.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
And she's like, but I created this thing and I don't want you doing that.
Yeah.
And they're like, we appreciate, you know, like your contributions and stuff, but, you know, we own this and we're going to do this. And so, like, that's still happening.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, that's totally right. I mean, DC may be paying people a little bit more now, and they sometimes give them bonuses when the characters appear in films or TV shows. But you still don't own the character, you know?
Yeah.
If it's published in a DC comic, you don't own it. And that's what I think the Image guys wanted. They wanted to own their own characters. And who blames them? I would too.
Right.
Well, there was like the big controversy when Disney bought Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they got a ton of IP through that. And they also bought Fox.
Yep.
Then they got a ton of IP through that. And there were authors who had written novels
that were using part these of those characters. IP. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And those novels were still in print. Those novels were still being purchased. Those novels were still out there. And the authors were no longer receiving royalties because Disney said, well, that's not our responsibility. We didn't do those contracts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they need to file suit, which I don't normally say to people, but I think – maybe I'm prejudiced. I still haven't forgiven Disney for making Howard the Duck wear pants. So I'm still gonna grudge.
Was that Disney or was that George Lucas?
No, that was Disney. They were suing because they thought he looked too much like Donald. So he got a pair of pants.
Oh, you're talking about
and
the
now
comic,
they own
not
both
the movie.
Characters.
Yeah, now they own both characters. Yeah. That's how Howard was in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That is wow.
Mm-hmm.
I
want to say that if, you know, I know some people are listening, if they are as old as me, they'll remember what happened in 75 and the pensions. And I just want to say, if you think that's the end of the story, it is so not. Because there's 50 more years of strife and conflict.
It's been a minute.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably making this sound really dark and depressing, but it does ultimately come to a happier ending. Perfect, sure. No, but a lot better.
Yeah, because the fans also pushed for their names to be in the Superman movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a wonderful story that Laura told me. That was the blackmail part of the PR campaign in 75. We don't want bad publicity for this Christopher Reeve movie we've got coming out.
Yeah.
So they finally give them the pension and restore their name to the feature. And so, and they get invited to the red carpet premiere of the first Superman, the movie, I think it was called, yeah. with Christopher Reeve. So they're sitting there in the theater. Lara's there with both of her parents, you know. She's got Clark Kent on the left and Lois Lane on the right, holding both of their hands. And there's that moment, you'll remember 4 minutes and 16 seconds into the film. You remember how the credits kind of whooshed out of the audience in that blueprint. So at 4 minutes and 16 in, whoosh, Superman, created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And the audience in the theater just erupts. They start cheering and applauding. And Lara feels both parents squeezing her hand. And she looks over at her dad. He's got tears streaming down his face. It meant so much to him to finally see his name associated with his character again, just when he's making it to the big screen. Yeah.
I think we're kind of beginning to come full circle here to where we started with the episode. And I was asking Patrick about characters and runs of characters that mattered to him. And, you know, us both, you know, shrugging shoulders and saying, like, I didn't always pay attention to who was writing or who was drawing or what were actually the names on the book. And I think that, although, like, as you said, William, this is not the full story here. There's much more that happens after Superman, the movie in 75. This is a reminder that if fans really pay attention to who are the people who are doing the work of bringing them the things they love, that they can play a part in advocating for those people, and they can play a part in supporting them. And especially in a world now where information can travel more quickly and more freely, and more can be done to organize, you know, sentiments and resistances and so on. If there are things that you love that you see people being done wrong by, then we are in a place now as fans where we can try to do the battle for truth, justice, and not just the American way, but like the things that matter.
Yeah, the better tomorrow. All the things that ironically the creators of Superman did not get.
Yeah.
That's what Superman ends up standing for. I think you're totally right. I think sometimes fans, readers, whatever you want to call them, do not realize how much power and influence they really have. And that comes out very clear in this story. And the other big takeaway for me is the importance of family. Because as I bet Patrick already knows, every time you pick up a Superman comic today, it'll say Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster by special arrangement with the Jerry Siegel family. Why is that there? Well, you'll find out in the book. But basically, it's because that family stood up and fought for decades. Why is the Shuster family not in there? Because they didn't. Unfortunately, they got rookie dude and sold out cheap, and now they're barred from bringing some of the litigation that the Siegel family did. But it was first Jerry, and then when he passed, Joanne took up the fight. Warner lawyers were still noticing, I think, her third deposition when she was 93 years old, dragging it out for years. That's the kind of litigation this was. And then she passes, and Lara picks up the torch. That last lawsuit ran for about 20 years.
Wow.
But it does finally end up in a better place.
Awesome. Well, this is a hell of a story you have captured for us here. And I'm going to be so gratified to read it. In the meantime, though, it would be gratifying to do Picks of the Week with you.
Ah, okay.
We'll get to Picks of the Week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere, but you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it. A lot of other people are enjoying it. But our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
All right. So, Patrick, give us a pick, good sir.
So kind of in line with what you're talking about with fans doing stuff, like I've been kind of vocal, especially online, about I don't care for the way Hasbro as a company treats people. Mm-hmm. So I don't like the way they treat their employees. They own Wizards of the Coast, which creates one of my favorite things ever, which is called Dungeons and Dragons. But I don't buy anything Dungeons and Dragons anymore because of the way Hasbro does business and doesn't. That's the way that I, as a fan, can kind of vote with my wallet, right? I vote with my wallet and I buy the things that I want to buy from the creators that I think are doing a decent job. And so to that end, I got something in the mail that I wasn't quite expecting. I did a Kickstarter or a backer kit of Paizo's Pathfinder Quest game. And so if you don't know Paizo creates Pathfinder, which is an alternative to Dungeons & Dragons, but it kind of was birthed through Dungeons & Dragons 3.5. But they're doing kind of their own thing now. And they came up with this board game called Pathfinder Quest, and they did a Kickstarter for it, and I was one of the backers. Pathfinder Quest is a cooperative adventure game for 1 to 4 players, and it has all the minis and stuff in there, and it has ways to just create characters on the fly with cards. And so it's kind of like playing a TTRPG, but you're actually playing a board game, which is really neat. And I haven't gotten everything that I'm supposed to through this Kickstarter because tariffs happened and all kinds of weird shit happened. And so they haven't been able to ship everything yet. But I appreciate the fact that they shipped anything at all, because a lot of the Kickstarters that I have done are still waiting to ship. Like, they haven't done anything. But this one came from Paizo, and it's Pathfinder. It's things that I love. Soon they will be selling this retail, I believe. So people will be able to go out and get it themselves. But I think it's really cool. I really enjoy what Paizo does. Obviously, I talk about it almost every time we have a show at this point. So I'm looking forward to getting together with some people and playing this game, Pathfinder Quest. And the box is huge. Tracy, did you see the picture of the box that I posted?
I did not. No. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's like 3 or 4 normal game boxes deep. Like, it's huge. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
But how can you boycott Hasbro? They own everything.
Have you
given up Magic the Gathering?
I have.
Oh, wow. Well, virtually all of the American-based board games are now owned by Hasbro because they bought up Parker Brothers and they brought up Milton Bradley. And you giving up all of those too?
Yes.
We've advanced beyond them in our gaming. We're now Eurotrash and Ameritrash people.
Well, so, that's where the best games are today. But
yeah,
still.
Yeah,
yeah. So I play Pathfinder and I play Starfinder, which are Paizo's games. I talked my friends into playing a Pathfinder campaign, and then one of them was running a 5e D&D campaign. When that campaign ended, I lobbied for, and he agreed to run a Pathfinder campaign. So I'm in two games every month that are Pathfinder, one that I'm running, one that my friend's running. I switched them from D&D. I switched all my other friends from D&D. So they're not playing D&D anymore. I haven't bought a Magic card in years and years and years and years.
Wow.
I don't buy Hasbro books anymore. I'm not going to do their subscription stuff because what they're doing is they're moving everything from physical media to online subscriptions. Mm-hmm. And you have to have an online subscription to get stuff because they're like, books are going to be collector's items, is what they said.
I like that, though. That's basically your way of, to use the current phrase, standing up to power.
Correct.
Which is important, I think.
Yep. And when I go to the game store where I do, I'm also a GM in Pathfinder Society, which is organized play. When I go to the game store, I talk about that. I talk about these things. And I'm like, you know, Magic the Gathering at Wizards of the Coast, the employees there are trying to form a union to protect themselves from Hasbro because they think Hasbro is going to do bad things to them. Mm-hmm. And Hasbro doesn't want them to do that. You know, mm-hmm. they're not recognizing the union. Like, there's stuff that just keeps happening over and over and over again that I just don't like them as a company anymore. So the only thing that I can do, literally the only thing that I can do, is not ever give them any money.
There you go.
Well, there you go. You're a man of good convictions. So, William, talk to us about a pick for you.
Well, this will be no surprise to you, Tracy, as we talked about it before. The people who are listening to this can't see, but I could see that there's a wall of board games behind you, including Seven Wonders at the top left. Just in case there's somebody who's been living in a cave for 20 years, Seven Wonders is one of the best and most popular new board games of the past, I don't know what, 20 years. It's family friendly. It's, it plays quickly. And all the spinoffs and expansions, mixed bag, but really none have been terrible. Anyway, last week I was traveling with my daughter Alice. We were going through the Southwest and doing a lot of hiking and stuff. But I brought the new Seven Wonders dice, which is basically a roll and write version of Seven Wonders. And just to be clear, I'm not even the world's biggest fan of roll and writes, but this is a good game. It stands on its own. It uses some of the iconography of Seven Wonders, but it's a different game. Mm-hmm. And what I really thought was cool is you roll the dice and everybody plays off the same dice. So you're taking turns simultaneously, so it plays quickly. Plus, it's a level playing field. It's not the usual Seven Wonders experience where if you're sitting to the left of my daughter, you're never going to get any green cards.
Go, Alice. Right.
So this was, she still won every single time, but I thought this was a really good variation on the theme.
Plus, I bet you don't have like 500 cards that some of your more anxious friends want to sleeve.
Well, and it's perfect for travel because it's a relatively small box with not that many pieces.
That's a great pick.
Suddenly my pick is that I want both of your daughters to play Seven Wonders together.
I have a son and a daughter, and my son will play board games and is generally pretty good at them, but he's not enthusiastic about them. Deirdre both will play them and is enthusiastic about them. She's also fundamentally vicious. in a very charming way. She'll fleece you and you'll be grinning at the end of it.
I just think that would be fun to watch.
It's like that in my family too, because Alice's younger brother, Ralph, will play games, but I don't think he's as into it as Alice and I are, probably because he grew up always being beaten at board games by his big sister. He is, however, a really good D&D dungeon master.
Oh,
there
nice.
You go. Nice.
Well, those skills do transfer to Pathfinder. I'm just saying.
You're working on your recruitment drive here, I can see.
I'll pass that along. He'll like the evil Hasbro idea.
Ralph, stand up to the man. that's fantastic. We got what great picks we've got here. So I've my pick of the week is kind of like a part of the extended universe of the Townsend household. Folks who have been listening for a while know that about a year ago, around this time, Deirdre and I got into watching the Resident Alien television series starring Alan Tudyk, which is kind of a cozy mystery science fiction humor thing. And we've had a great time with it. Actually, we are recording this on the 6th of June. And so this is actually the day that the final season of the Resident Alien television show drops on Netflix. So I'm pretty positive I know what's going to be happening with me later this evening, if Deirdre has anything to say about it. But one of the things that I decided to do when I had to take kind of an emergency, unexpected trip in this past week was quickly download some new comics to read onto my Hoopla app. And I decided, you know what, I want to know what the Resident Alien comics are like, because they are based on a series of comics that published by Dark Horse. The creators of them are Peter Hogan and Steve Parkhouse, because we like to talk about the creators here. It's the theme of the episode and generally for the show we do here. And it's been a really interesting experience kind of getting a sense of the creative space that exists between the television show versus the comics. And so my pick of the week is, in fact, the Resident Alien comics themselves. They came out starting in 2012 in a sort of batches of miniseries, but they have had publications as recently as April of 2026. And so it is a story that's not quite complete. There's still bits and pieces of it being told. But I really admire Parkhouse's art. And one of the things that I think is especially clever about how the comic is done is because they don't, of course, have the features of television to kind of work as reminders of Harry VanderSpiegel being an alien. And plus they don't have Alan Tudyk's face to right. be something that they want to use all the time. And so in the comics, the reader is always seeing Harry VanderSpiegel as an alien in human clothes, walking around doing human things. And the presumed state of everyone else's perceptions is that they are seeing the Harry VanderSpiegel that he wants them to see. There are a number of other differences that I don't need to get into here for the sake of the recommendation, but if you haven't checked it out before and you're curious, I know it's available in my library system through the Hoopla app, and more than likely is available to you in a variety of different means, including going to your friendly local comics shop.
That's cool. It reminds me of when Wynonna Earp came out.
Yeah.
On the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi. Mm-hmm. And I started watching it and I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I was like, huh, this is based on comics. And so I then got the comic books and they were so different.
Yeah.
I was like, huh, okay. Like they went in a completely different direction for the TV show. So
I didn't realize there was a Wynonna Earp comic book. I knew about the Resident Alien ones. And I had a similar experience to yours. I went to, after watching the show, and they were so much more serious and, a different art style.
Yeah, they're not really interested in the comedy angle at all.
It was very, very, it almost seemed like two different unrelated things, though I still enjoyed them.
Yeah.
The premise of Wynonna Earp is the same. And I think it's the same thing with Resident Evil or Alien. Resident Evil. Thinking comic,
slightly different vibe there.
Game video games now. The premise is still the same, with the legacy and the gun and all that kind of stuff and Wyatt Earp's legacy for Wynonna Earp. But the way they approach it is completely different in the show versus the comics. Yeah. So.
Well, I always love – I do love kind of seeing – the difference in adaptations. I'm one of those people where I don't get really worked up about adaptations being different from source material because I'm much more sanguine about seeing them as just different things, period. And so that's always kind of fun for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, William, it has been wonderful talking to you.
I agree. It's been a blast.
Yeah. And for listeners who are excited by this conversation, good news, that Superman Wars actually came out in April. So it is already out there for you to find and enjoy. And we recommend that you do that. And what else can people find you and the super cool stuff that you make?
Because I believe you said something about having 453 other titles available for folks.
66. This is my 66th book.
You rounded up. It's fine. I rounded
first
up.
Time in the, yeah, you rounded. What's immediately coming up? In the world of books, we already hinted, next year I'm doing the Batman Wars, where I will attempt to do for Bill Finger what I did here for Jerry Siegel, although they are two very different people,
yeah,
trapped in, unfortunately, similar circumstances. I also host a writing conference every year. It's called WriterCon. Mm-hmm. You'll get that since you've been to Comic Cons, probably. Other people are baffled, but WriterCon, and it's in Oklahoma City every Labor Day weekend. This year, that's September 4th through 7. We've got over 60 writers coming to speak, and over a dozen agents and publishers, and everybody gets together and learns what they need to know so that they can advance their writing careers. But I always do the opening ceremony. It's like 20 minutes. And the thing I always emphasize is, hey, meet people while you're here. I know you're probably all introverts and you'd rather be at the library, but force yourself to make a friend, because there's going to come a time when you need to ask somebody, is this a real publisher or a vanity press, or is this a real offer or some AI slop or whatever it is? You know, you meet an agent, meet a lawyer, get whatever you need. So what happened to Jerry Siegel does not happen to you, because unfortunately it does still happen. People are still getting ripped off. I see it at small group retreats every year, and you know, we just got to get the word out. So that, in my experience, writers are the best, most generous people on earth, but also nice. And sometimes business takes advantage of nice. So we have to stick together and make sure that doesn't happen.
Money should always flow to the author, not away from the author.
Indeed. Well, that's how I see it. So
I was on a panel last year where at the end, one of the other people, I did not know that they were going to say this, but one of the other people's like, oh, and I have this publishing company, and you know, we have these tiers of pricing to get you started. And I immediately said, that's a vanity press.
Yeah.
Anytime someone asks you to pay to be published, that's a vanity press. And so I'm pretty sure that person's never going to speak to me again.
I don't care whether they call it pay. Sometimes they call it a marketing fee or some other.
Yeah.
And now we have vanity presses that are aligned with big five New York publishers, you know, the Witness line at HarperCollins, or there's a similar line. I won't go down the list, but I've had people show up who have blown $15,000 getting their children's book published. Well, now they've got it and they can hold it, but nobody's ever going to see it. It's not being marketed. It's not in bookstores. It's not going anywhere. It's just, taking people's money, taking advantage of people's hopes and dreams to make a little money. And
I know we have listeners who are writers and who are in various stages of their publication journeys and processes. So if you don't want to be the next Jerry Siegel or Bill Finger.
Except for the part about creating Superman.
Right, create awesome things. Do that. Like, put a pin in that one right there, right? Yeah. But if you don't want all the rest of that stuff, it sounds like William's got your back here with WriterCon and Labor Day weekend.
There you go.
Website's writercon.com. You can log on and find out all about it. Thanks for mentioning it.
Oh, and then you also have a website, right, for yourself?
I do. Author? It's predictably williambernhardt.com, and you can go log on and find out more than you ever wanted to know about me and see all those cool. I mention my youngest, Ralph, is a professional photographer, and so
nice.
I've got good photos, if nothing else.
Fantastic. Well, it has been a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a treat. Let's do it again next year for Batman.
Heck yeah.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the-functional-nerds on Facebook. At functionalnerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way. So hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at thefunctionalnerds.bluesky, which is BSKY, .social. I know. I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching. If you want me, it's ATFMB because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent. So you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know. It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.